China's new mental health law on China law and policy. Welcome to our podcast. On June 10, 2011, the Commission for Legislative Affairs of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress released a draft mental health law for public comment. While various local governments have issued local mental health regulations, the draft published by the Legislative Affairs Commission is the first national law regulating all areas of China. The Chinese government has announced its intention to adopt a final version of the mental health law by year's end. Since the issuance of the draft in June, one aspect of the law that has received particular public comment is the continued ability of the state to involuntarily commit an individual to a mental institution if the person exhibits behavior that, quote-unquote, disturbs public order. Public interest lawyer Huang Xuetao and law professor Li Xuan have both commented that including quote-unquote, disrupts public order as evidence of mental illness could easily be abused to detain healthy individuals for political purposes. As Professor Michael Perlin of New York Law School points out in his new book, International Human Rights and Mental Disability Law, When the Silenced Are Heard, China has a history of using involuntary institutional commitment as a means to squash dissent. China Law and Policy has Professor Perlin here to learn more about this history and also China's future as it seeks to adopt its first mental health law. Thank you, Professor Perlin, for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Let's begin by talking about your new book, specifically Chapter 4, which discusses the use of mental disability law to suppress political dissent. How long has China been using involuntary commitment to suppress dissent?
We know that it has been going on back at least 40 years. It may be before that. We don't know. This was written about first and most extensively by Robin Munro, who brought most of this to the public attention. And he gave some very, very serious examples of the misuse of state-sanctioned psychiatry in support of commitment to people who, by any sort of standard normative reason, would not have needed commitment. Sometimes it was done for political reasons. Sometimes it was done for financial reasons. There's this whole sort of other set of cases in which people wanted to get rid of a relative because they wanted to take over a business or something. And that actually is that was not unfamiliar to those who knew about this in the United States at about the same time. But clearly it was being used to suppress political dissent. And when I wrote Chapter 4 of this new book, a lot of it flows from an article that I had done about 5 years before in the Israel Law Review. And when I did that research, it was kind of interesting to me. Most people know, or people who are interested in sort of this whole general area, know that the former Soviet Union, this was very common.
Right.
And there were exposés. The World Psychiatric Association sent a delegation in the late 80s, early 90s. There were quite a few books written about it and articles. I said exposés. But China, at that point, nobody seemed to pay that much attention to. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty clear the same kinds of things were going on in China as were going on in the Soviet Union. Fast forward, the Iron Curtain fell. Some of the abuses, not all, in the former Soviet Union had been remediated to some extent, but again, what was happening in China was pretty much under the radar. It became known, interestingly, with regard to what is seen as the persecution of the Falun Gong.
Okay.
You know, who, you know, is it a political group? Is it a kind of exercise? Is it metaphysical? You know, I can't answer that, but it seemed very, very clear to me and to most neutral observers that practitioners and adherents were being singled out and they were being marginalized mm-hmm. as mentally ill. And, you know, one of the things we'll talk about later is sort of like, why do governments do this?
Right, right.
And I'll discuss that in a few minutes. But it seemed to me that China, in many ways, a lot of what was done was paralleling. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is in this new draft act, about which I'm enormously ambivalent, I should tell you, I think, and I've sent some comments to other people about it, I think there's some things that certainly are better than China has had before, but an awful lot of it strikes me as very problematical.
Right.
You know, and certainly, what would certainly not only not meet constitutional standards in a Western country, but also, I think, pretty clearly, does not comport with the Convention on the Rights of Persons with mm-hmm. Disabilities, mm-hmm. which China has ratified.
Right.
It seems to me that under this new law and what you mentioned, in Article 27 about the disturbs public order should be a red flag.
Yeah.
Because what does that mean? I mean, we're sitting here in my office on the corner of West Broadway and Leonard Street, and how far are we from Wall Street, where there's an occupation going on now that seems to be spreading, and is this disturbing the public order? One could, you know, read the pages on Facebook, and an awful lot of American citizens think it is. Mm-hmm. If something like this were being done in Beijing or Shanghai, would everybody be, could everybody be dragged away to a psychiatric hospital under the strict language of the act? Yeah, it probably could.
Well, in terms of that, I mean, that's one of, and you sort of mentioned it in your answer, is, I mean, the Chinese government itself has the power under even the criminal law, arguably. I mean, maybe it's not directly stated in the criminal law, but they use the power to detain people indefinitely.
Right.
Why do they choose to, for example, with Falun Gong and other dissidents, why do they choose to use a mental health, not verdict, but a mental health analysis instead of using the criminal law when they're basically an authoritarian state? I mean, why did the Soviet Union do that? Why does China continue to do that?
I mean, it seems to me there are at least three main reasons for that, Elizabeth. That's really is a great question. First of all, there are always some, albeit minimal, procedural safeguards in the criminal process. They are not always adhered to, but I spent some time working in China with criminal defense lawyers, and I was teaching them how to do certain things, but I also spend much more time learning, and I realized it's not a lot. Those of us who have practiced criminal defense law in New York or New Jersey would go kind of, oh my God, but at least there's something there.
Right.
There's nothing there on the psychiatric mm-hmm. commitment side. So that's number one. Number two, when there is a hearing, when there is an adjudication, there is usually a limit to the sentence. It may be a draconian sentence. It may be for many more years than we would think makes sense, but at least there is a number there. Mm-hmm. Psychiatric commitment is, in these jurisdictions, indefinite. And I should say, after the CRPD, the convention, is ratified, I don't think indefinite commitment without clear judicial review passes muster under international human rights law, period. Mm-hmm. But the third, I think, is the most important, because I think the third, it stigmatizes. We know that if we call somebody a mental patient, he will be discredited. And if he has political motives, that will mean, well, we can ignore them. I use this example, I think, in that book, about somebody in Romania, when Romania was a completely authoritarian state, who was picked up. And his psychiatric charge was he was carrying a sign saying that the prime minister of the country must go. And the answer is, well, if he thought he actually was serious, that somebody would listen to him, he must be crazy. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right,
it's
right.
A loop. But I think those three reasons together are really it.
Mm-hmm. And right now, I mean, before, I know they have the draft law published right now, and it was open for comments back in the summer. But before that, right now, how does involuntary commitment work? Are there laws in place? Who makes the decision if an individual should be involuntarily committed? How does it work?
The decision is made basically by the state. I mean, somebody mm-hmm. gets picked up very, very often. Family will call and ask, you know, take my relative and send him to the hospital. And there is no independent assessment mm-hmm. of... In 1985, I should say to your listeners, I've been a professor since the mid-1980s, but I was a real lawyer. Before that, I practiced 13 years both as a criminal defense lawyer and as an advocate for persons with mental disabilities. I filed an amicus brief in the U.S. Supreme Court in 1985 in a case called Ake versus Oklahoma, in which the Supreme Court ruled that a person who was indigent had a right to... a psychiatric evaluation at state expense if he was putting forth the insanity defense. Mm-hmm. The idea being that this is something that can't simply be done on the say-so of, decided on the say-so of the state doctor. In China, it's always done on the say-so of the state doctor. Okay. There is virtually no sense of independence. There's also no lawyer appointed. One of the issues that I think is really important, we know this. We know that both in among the United States and in other nations, serious mental health reform only happens when there are lawyers assigned to represent patients. I know that sounds very lawyer-centric. Pardon me, I plead guilty to that. But if you were to go into the United States, go state by state, and see where has there been reform, where has there not, it's an easy question. Where have there been lawyers, like in New York, the Mental Hygiene Legal Service, like in New Jersey, the Mental Health Advocacy Office, like in D.C., the Public Defender Service Mental Health Division, that's where it happens. Mm-hmm. In other nations where you have it, Israel is a nation that has a robust public defender's office doing these things, and they're enormously successful. Where there are no lawyers, reform doesn't happen. There are no lawyers doing these cases mm-hmm. on the ground in China. I believe that after ratification of the CRPD, this needs to happen. Commitment must be subject to the judicial process at every step. That is demanded by the CRPD, and it's not in the draft act, much less in the older
right.
law.
So to clarify, the draft mental health law that's been proposed has no provisions for a lawyer to be appointed,
correct.
And there's no independent review of a state's decision.
One can ask for a review, but there's absolutely it's utterly optional. There's mm-hmm. no sense, it's not obligatory, it's okay. not mandatory.
And now in terms of involuntary commitment, you say the decision's made by the state. Would that be, I mean, what division of the state? Is that the Ministry of Public Security or who?
It's not clear. You have sort of two different ways it mm-hmm. happens. You've got the Ministry of Public Security and these whole Ankang hospitals mm-hmm, that are mm-hmm. really shrouded. I mean, you know, I heard about them. Oh, my goodness. I've been in doing mental disability work for my whole career. I've been doing international human rights mental disability work for 11 years. I've been going to Asia for 9 years. But it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years ago I even heard about these hospitals. You know, and they operate, there's virtually no way to find out what's going on in them. And that, you know, that ministry is public security. The others go through the Ministry of Health, I believe.
Okay. But so the Hong Kong hospitals are within the Ministry
of Public Security. And those involve, you know, people who are, you know, have... you know, are seen as being criminally dangerous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's very, very murky. I mean,
right.
a line between criminality and other kind of dangerous behavior, and very often it's what you choose to call it.
Yeah.
But there's very little, there's no review, and there's very little outsider involvement. It's mm-hmm. like a world in and of itself.
Yeah. And in terms of that line between criminality and involuntary commitment, I mean, one of the things that is being heavily criticized both by foreign scholars and even Chinese legal scholars is this continued use of disturbing public
right.
order.
Right.
And that's included in the new draft mental health law.
Absolutely.
And my question, I mean, just to get to the people who write this law, is there any sincerity in the use of this term? I mean, does the Chinese government believe that, I mean, is there sincerity in the belief that perhaps the expression of a different opinion is evidence of mental, I mean, you know, and then how do they get doctors on board with that?
It's very hard for me to tell what was in their minds. There's no
mm-hmm,
record
right, right.
of this.
Mm-hmm.
And you can come up with, I think, multiple explanations, Elizabeth. On one hand, you could look at it just plain meaning. Endanger public safety means somebody is standing in the middle of a main street screaming at cars, right?
Right.
And, you know, that could cause an accident. And that, you and I would agree, might endanger public safety. And that's one possibility. Another is anybody, and we certainly have, and in this study that was done by the Equity and Justice Initiative of Psychiatry and Society Watch that was published recently, which analyzes this commitment system in China, I mean, it is replete with examples of people who were picked up and psychiatrically hospitalized because basically they were seen as dissidents. I mean, that's
right.
an overused word. And I am very concerned in any jurisdiction, but especially in a jurisdiction that has this kind of track record
mm-hmm.
of locking people up for disagreeing politically, I am very concerned that this kind of language, like in Article 27, is far too overbroad.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that as a real issue. Sort of, why do state psychiatrists go along with it? This is something I've been trying to deal with for 20 years in terms of thinking about it, and you don't know. I remember reading one study in which the researchers said, they said, well, you know, if we went along for the ride, we would get more vacation days or get a nice home at the beach, something like
mm-hmm.
that, which sounds so depressingly banal, right? But it also, in fact, may be so. Some may also feel as if they're an arm of the state.
Yeah.
I have heard, I've been in meetings, so your listeners know, I've been to mainland China 5 or 6 times. I've done quite a bit of work there, and I've been at meetings with psychiatrists, and I've sort of tried to listen to what people say. And very often, you know, as and most recently I was in Beijing in June or July this summer, and I heard a psychiatrist say, well, you know, I can kind of look at this guy in the eyes and I'll know if he needs to be institutionalized. No, that kind of behavior was repudiated. When I started practicing law, I heard doctors say that. That's been repudiated in the States for the last 20, 30
right.
years. Very, very much of what I heard on this last trip to Beijing, Yogi Berra said it's deja vu all over again. Very much of what I heard was very close to what I heard in the early 1970s when I started mm-hmm. practicing law in New Jersey.
Well, in that regards, and this is a little maybe off topic because it's not as much related to law, but has there been efforts? I mean, I know there's a lot of rule of law projects from mm-hmm. the U.S. and China to help strengthen the legal profession.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been efforts to maybe strengthen the professional mindedness of the psychiatry profession in China? Has there been any attempts to do that and hopefully through that way develop a grassroots feeling of independence, or is that something that might be just too difficult?
If this was a TV show rather than a podcast, your listeners would be sort of seeing my face at this moment, right? Yeah, kind of, maybe a little bit, not much. I know mm-hmm. the World Medical Association has taken seriously some of these issues. There's a psychiatrist in Mamaroneck, New York, Dr. Abraham Halpern, one of my heroes, and Abe has been working on some of these issues for the last 30, 40 years. He's mostly focusing on things like organ transplants now, but he has been a gadfly to the World Medical Association, encouraging it. Mm-hmm. David Matos of Canada the same mm-hmm. way, but generally not so much. I don't see this. And there's an interesting subtext issue here. One of the things I write about, and I discuss it extensively in this book, is what I call sanism. Sanism is the kind of irrational prejudice like racism, like sexism, like homophobia, in which we stereotype people with mental disabilities, we trivialize them, we typify them, we don't take them very seriously, we treat them as less than people.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, we generally, we meaning society, pay much less attention to what psychiatrists do with purportedly quote-unquote crazy people than we do when there are other violations. When people mistreat women, when people mistreat children, when people mistreat gays, there is a predictable and appropriate outrage on page one on all the blogs, blah, blah. It doesn't happen
mm-hmm,
here.
Mm-hmm.
Internationally, there's really one organization, a group called the Mental Disability Advocacy Center, located mostly in Budapest, a couple of other sites in Europe, that is doing this work on a global level. I am working with my friend and colleague Yoshi Ikahara, who's head of the Tokyo Advocacy Law Office, as I said before, before we went on the air, to create a disability rights tribunal for Asia and the Pacific, but there's very little else that's being done. This is a population that people, even people who see themselves as traditional liberals, traditionally progressives, traditionally focusing on social justice, would just as well go away. They
mm-hmm.
think it's yucky.
Right. And in terms, I mean, focusing on the international efforts, you had mentioned the CRPD. What international law is out there that would, I guess, push China forward in this regards? And, you know, since China has ratified some of the treaties, what can be done on an international level?
That's
just issuing reports that they're in violation of the treaty.
That's the hardest question, Elizabeth. It's the most important question. This treaty, which has been on the books for 3 years...
And this is the CRPD.
The CRPD.
Which stands for
the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, right. is without any question the broadest document ever written on behalf of this population. Importantly, it repudiates the medical model and substitutes a social model of disability. In other words, this is not simply we have sick people, this is society deals with this population in a certain way and we have to sort of figure out what to do. Irony, off to the side. What's so interesting to me is how the role of psychologists is so limited in this draft
mm-hmm.
act. The CRPD moves away from the medical model. As such, psychologists, non-physicians, the use of them, the reliance on them should increase, not decrease. One of the things that I'm seeing between the lines with my magic decoder ring on is that there are struggles between the psychiatric trade associations and the psychological trade associations in China. The psychiatrists have much more political clout, mm-hmm. much more legislative clout. So this is basically guild stuff.
Right,
and
right.
That's there. So going back to what you said before, it's clear to me, and I write about that extensively in the book, there are many articles mm-hmm. that talk about due process, basically, that talk about freedom from torture, freedom from cruel and unusual punishment, anti-discrimination, access to justice, on and on. And again, you know, I can be happy to send you some of the more recent things that I've written about it since I've written that book. And it seems to me that China is failing at all of those. Mm-hmm. But then comes the question, and so what? What are you going to do? What can
right,
you do?
Right.
One of the reasons why Yoshi and I are devoting so much time to the creation of what we call DRTAP, D-R-T-A-P, the Disability Rights Tribunal for Asia and the Pacific, is because in Africa, there's a Commission on Human Rights. In Europe, there is a Commission on Human Rights. In Latin America, there is a court, rather, on human rights. In each case, court, not commission. There's nothing in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
There have been seminars. There have been meetings. There's this group called ASEAN that about seven nations are maybe belong to some, 10 belong to others. But there is no Asian-wide tribunal. Why? Good question. People talk about Asian values. I reject that, and I can talk about that later if you want me to. But without that, a person can, ostensibly, theoretically, appeal any kind of a decision directly to the Human Rights Council of the United Nations.
Right.
That's pretty difficult for anybody
yeah.
to do.
Yeah.
It's difficult for a person in a nation with a developed economy, what we would call the first world, to
mm-hmm.
do. It is certainly virtually impossible for somebody in China to do without a lawyer, especially if somebody is, you know, not in Beijing or Shanghai or one of the major cities. When I went to I went to Xi'an a couple times to do some work, and I talked to a lawyer, said, Professor Perlin, I'm not sure if you understand, in our province we get to court by horseback.
Yeah.
And this is in about 2007 or 2008. This is not 20 years ago. So they're basically, they have, at this point in time, almost no legal resource. All you can do is the court of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We're
mm-hmm.
trying to do that. But again, I am very saddened and disappointed that this issue has not sort of spread beyond the small circle of people who take this seriously, who care about it, who write about it, who foment about it. And I think some of the reasons for that, Elizabeth, is sanism.
Yeah.
That these people are just simply seen as not human, not as important.
So are you saying that this issue hasn't spread beyond the small group that focuses on it? So a lot of maybe the U.S.'s projects in China, do they, I mean, are there U.S. rule of law projects that's pushing this? Is it more... I mean, is it also, I guess, in some ways, our fault, too?
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah. Clearly it's our fault, yeah. It is our fault. I think, you know, I'm on the China Law Listserv, as you are, and if you spend a month there, you'll see there are certain topics that get written about a lot. Some very serious topics. I mean, certainly, there are serious human rights issues, arrest of dissidents, things of that sort, but most of it goes to business law. And that does not go to business law. A lot goes to things that are extremely important, like environmental law. I mean, you know,
yeah.
anyone like you or I who have spent time in China know how serious these problems are. But there is virtually no attention paid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can count. You and I could sit down after this is over and count on one hand the people who have done substantive posts in the last 3 years about this issue on that listserv, and we'd have a couple of digits left over.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that general rule of law people, general just society people, I can fault for not taking this seriously enough. And I know people say, well, you know, everyone has their priorities, we can't do everything, and that's true.
Right.
But this is an area that virtually nobody is taking seriously.
So I guess then back to China, in terms of the new draft mental health law, I mean, you
right.
said that you're extremely ambivalent about it.
Right.
I mean, could you talk more about your feelings about
sure.
it? What's good?
Okay.
What's not good?
The fact that there is a law.
Yeah.
The fact that it sort of talks about the fact that there has to be some kind of structure to this.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, you know, at least there will be something to assess, something to test. But let me laundry list some things that I think are problematic. First of all, I don't think whoever drafted it ever looked at the CRPD.
Mm-hmm.
It does not appear to me that that was ever, and that should have been. When I talk, Elizabeth, to people, and I'm, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've gone and I've done human rights law on every continent, except for Antarctica. The penguins still haven't asked for me. I'll say to people now, when you rewrite your law, I was in Argentina 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I spoke to the World Psychiatric Association, and I talked to people from several nations. They said exactly the same thing. If you are rewriting your law, on the left side of your desk, you need the CRPD. And for every section you write, go and look at the cognate section and say, are we in line with this or not?
Well, let me just interrupt you for a second about that. I know there's been a lot of talk about the criminal procedure law, who's assisted in drafting that.
Right.
Do you have any idea which agencies of the government have assisted in drafting the mental health law? If there's been any famous academic, is there any transparency about that?
I don't know. It may have happened, but I simply don't know. Or, you know, it's something that I'm just not part of those conversations.
Okay.
As I said before, again, call me lawyer-centric. I think there needs to be appointment of counsel, period.
Okay.
Articles 29 through 32 talk about maybe commissioning a forensic mental disability evaluation agency for second opinions in some cases, but without a counsel, I don't think it's going to really make very much difference. And I think every aspect of commitment has to be subject to the judicial process every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of other things that I sort of saw while going through it. On Monday in my class on survey of mental disability law, we talked about the topic of sexual autonomy, the rights of persons to have some kind of sexual freedom. And I've written about this. An article I wrote in the Washington Law Review a few years ago about sexuality issues in Asia and in China. You might find that of some interest. About it there. The criteria for commitment are not really clear. There has to be a causal relationship between mental illness and risk and dangerousness. That is never spelled out. There is nothing about the institutionalized patient's right to refuse medication, a huge, huge issue. There's a whole thing in Article 24 about when relatives can send a, quote, suspected mentally disabled person to the hospital without criteria. That's really, really problematic. And I think that's an issue that needs to be dealt with. Very, very often, somebody will come to a psychiatrist and say, doctor, my brother, sister, whatever, is crazy. And that becomes sort of the fact and evidence, even though there's no evidence before it.
Right,
and that's
right.
Where we start out. And I think that's really a serious, serious issue. As I said before, the endanger public safety language in Articles 26 and 27 are especially problematic, especially, Elizabeth, given China's history in this. Article 28 talks about diagnosis, but diagnosis is not risk assessment. A person can have what we would call in the States an Axis 1 diagnosis, schizophrenia, bipolar depression, major depression, and that does not mean they're committable, because you have to have with that, as a result of that, the likelihood of serious danger to self or others. That is not spelled out at all. The possibility that everybody's ballyhooed in Article 29 about this sort of duplicate examination, I'm not convinced at all that it's going to be really independent. Starting in Article 30, it talks about forensics, but I'm really puzzled because there's nothing else in here about the criminal process. It's just not clear to me what that is. I think rights need to be enumerated if you go ahead to Article 34. We also have to articulate the fact, and again, this is consonant both with the CRPD and all developments of the last 40 plus years, that the right to treatment has to be in the least restrictive alternative. We have to talk about community treatment. We have to talk about deinstitutionalization. We have to talk about congregate care, halfway house, on and on. That's not here anywhere. Psychosurgery is discussed in Article 39. Absolutely not. That should never be an acceptable treatment. I was puzzled again, as I said to you, by the lack of how psychologists appear to me to be squeezed out. And again, I see this as kind of guild mentality issue. It troubles me a lot. What can be done about this? I'm not that smart. I have sent my comments into other people who hopefully have the ear of those who do listen. Hopefully something will happen. But I looked in my file before you got here. I have not gotten anything substantive on this in the last 2 months.
Right. Well, that's what I want to ask you in a close-out question, basically, is, there has been actually some verbal criticism by Chinese scholars about the draft mental health law, and highlighting a lot of the things you have mentioned, including the endangering public safety, disturbing public order issue. Do you think the Chinese government will listen to any of this criticism? I mean, do you anticipate that the draft will change before it's adopted? Or are these things that you think the Chinese government just hasn't been able to get past yet?
I wish I knew, Elizabeth. You know, I say jokingly I'm smart. I'm not that smart. There will be some changes. I think if they made no changes at all, that would be a public relations disaster. Because that would mean we are ignoring everybody. We're doing just what we want and take a hike. Mm-hmm. There will be some changes. And I'll say some of it will be better. How much of it, 10%, a quarter, I don't know. I wish I could be more optimistic and say, oh, they're going to listen to everything we say. No, get real, they're not.
Yeah.
But I am hopeful that it will be incrementally better, and the way that it is written will give us more, and give people who are on the ground more to work with. I mean, I'm very sensitive to the fact, you know, I go to China once a year, at the very most twice a year. I live in New Jersey, I work in New York, I'm a foreigner, I'm an outsider. And all I can do is, you know, is listen and learn and share some ideas. It has to be done by the people on the ground.
Right.
And I certainly spend, you know, a good deal of time talking to them. And I hope that as a result of that, something happens. I've been doing this work for a long, long time. I remain an unflaggingly optimistic guy. So I hope it's going to happen.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll find out. It's supposed to be passed by year end. Thank you very much, Professor Perlin, for your time and your knowledge.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It was a pleasure.